Today we're doing our legislative update. We're very pleased to have Deborah Lacombe, Deputy General Counsel, who's been with the program for a long time. This is definitely our most popular monthly CLE, Deborah, so and credit that all to your knowledge and hard work in preparing this. I'm going to hand it over to Deborah, but before I do, I just want to remind everyone, please put your phone on mute so we don't hear you eating lunch or talking to your coworkers. Also, please do not hang up until the call is absolutely over. It's very disruptive. Every time you hang up, there's a little beep, as you just heard. And it's very disruptive and rude when people start hanging up before the call is over. So if you have to, I know people have to run a call and they have other things they have to do, put your phone down and just ask someone in your office to hang it up at 1:15 or 1:30 because it will definitely be over by then. Okay, with that, I'm going to hand it over to Deborah.
Thank you, Mary Kay. I really appreciate it. Thank you for calling in. I am going to just do an hour talking about the different things that happened in the legislative session this year and how it might affect guardian ad litem advocacy. We circulated a number of months ago and recirculated with the meeting notice a little chart that kind of gives a synopsis of each of the bills that passed related to Chapter 39. And what I'll do today is go into more detail on those. What I'm going to do is there are three bills that are just sort of informational, so I'll cover those first. I'll stop and ask everybody if they have any questions. Then I'm going to cover Senate Bill 126, which deals with access to records for children in foster care. I'll deal with House Bill 381, which is the Zahid Jones Jr. Give Grandparents and Other Relatives a Voice Act. And then Senate Bill 1128, which is on educational surrogacy. And after I finish with each of those, I'll stop and give you a chance to ask questions. The first section that I wanted to make you aware of are three bills that are probably not going to affect your practice right away, but I wanted you to be aware of them. The first is Senate Bill 1018, which relates to guardians ad litem. And we've gotten some calls at the state office and had to clarify why this change was made and what the impact of it is. The bill related to guardians ad litem this year dealt with Chapter 61 guardians ad litem. As you know, it's been a policy of the program for a long time that we need to be serving abused and neglected children first before we go into other divisions of court where kids are not subject to allegations of abuse and neglect. That policy was formalized by the legislature in proviso language, and we're actually prohibited from spending state funds on representation of children who are not in dependency court. So what that means for us and has for a number of years is we will not take a delinquency case or a dissolution case unless that child is already kind of part of the program because there's a pending dependency case. Conversely, if you have a dependency case and then a child is part of a domestic violence proceeding and it's in the best interest of the child for the guardian ad litem to be representing or present in those proceedings, then that is permissible. But what that meant practically in dissolution proceedings was there really wasn't a lot of guardian ad litem resources for judges. It was just the members of the bar who would serve, and then the statute allows guardian ad litem program, but since we were not doing that, there was a lack of guardians ad litem. So this session, they passed a bill that allows individuals certified by not-for-profit legal aid organizations to serve as guardians. They're lay volunteers. The legal aid organization is certifying them, doing a background check, training them. None of our funding. We're not involved in any way with that. The bill actually makes clear that there are no additional duties or obligations for the guardian ad litem program. So if you hear around the courthouse that the guardian ad litem program is accepting family cases now, you can understand that that is just a misunderstanding of what Senate Bill 1018 does. The second bill I just wanted to mention for guardian ad litem is Senate Bill 526, which was done by Senator Lynn and Representative Eisnagel. There has been a bill that increases the court costs on certain offenses, most of which involve minors, and part of the court costs will go to the guardian ad litem program. So that's not going to be a tremendous source of revenue. My understanding is that will be less than like $50,000. But again, if you are told that the guardian ad litem program is now getting court costs, that's what they're talking about. It's Senate Bill 526. The last one I wanted to mention is House Bill 1409, which was done by Representative Sands and Senator Rich, and it is dealing with the ICPC. As many of you know, that is a big source of frustration for a lot of people, and Florida has been working hard to improve its process, but the federal government has also been updating and revising and trying to incorporate best practices into the ICPC. So what happened this year is Florida passed a law which will enable it to enact the ICPC. And that's complicated only because what the federal law says is once 35 states enact the new ICPC, then the entire country will use the new ICPC. So even though we've passed a law saying, okay, you know, this looks good to us and we'd like to use the new ICPC, we're still going to be using the old one until 35 states around the country are on board, which, you know, makes sense. Then you have the majority of the country operating under the same regulations. So my understanding is, as of about a month ago, only about 10 states had actually done it. The good news is that the ICPC compact administrator for Florida, whose name is Steve Pennypacker and works with the Department of Children and Families, has taken a leadership position in the national organization of compact administrators, and it's sort of his mission, he informed me, to get the other states on board. There are a lot of really good provisions in there, some things about enforceability that we just don't have now, and really an improved product. So we're looking forward to that being something that we can do in the future, but I just wanted to clarify that the fact that we have, quote-unquote, passed a bill related to the ICPC does not mean that we are using the new federal version of the law. We're still using what we have. So those are the three kind of just quick informational things that I wanted to tell you about, and I'm going to stop now for just a couple seconds and see if anybody has questions on those. Okay, thank you. I'm going to jump into then Senate Bill 126, which is a bill by Senator Paula Dockery and Representative Peter Nair, and it is access of records for children in foster care. This is a bill that has been around for a couple of years and was actually identified as necessary by the Governor's Commission on Open Government. And the impetus for the bill was that foster care children, or youth aging out of foster care in particular, were giving feedback that they'd go to the department and try and get their records and would be told no, or no one could find them, or they would have to pay for them. And obviously that is ludicrous. So even though there are probably enough sort of places where that could be litigated, there was a desire to clarify the law so none of that was necessary, and to just really streamline the process and make it clear to everyone what responsibilities people had in terms of maintaining these records for kids and then making them available when the children and youth wanted them. So we have a brand new section in Chapter 39. It's 3900145, and that requires DCF, and then it uses language, and DCF's authorized agents and providers, specifically including the CBCs, to keep children's records in a complete and accurate manner. Subsection 2 of the law then clarifies that the child's guardian ad litem, the child's AAL, if the child has one, are entitled to view the records and have to be given a copy when requested. There are some provisions about making certain that the information is released in an appropriate setting. And when you look at what an appropriate setting is, the statute says that people should consider the child's age, maturity, and the nature of the information being released. But then it is clear that you can't use one of those circumstances to deny the child access to the records. So if you have a 15-year-old who wants his or her records and someone thinks that the information is just too, you know, shocking or harmful, that cannot be used as a basis to deny the child the records. And then the statute provides for penalties and fines if the children, the guardian, the AAL are denied access. So that's the part about it. The whole thing is about sharing information. So that's sort of the first element, which is it is now clear that children can and youth can access their records. The second piece that is really important is the law provides for sharing of confidential information between state and local agencies if the information is essential to ensuring that the child has access to needed services. So, you know, there have been situations where a particular agency is trying to serve a child but is not one of the entities listed under that big laundry list of people in 39202 who can have access to a child's records. So now the judge can sort of look at the situation and say, you know, you're entitled to this information, you're entitled to this information, just go ahead and share it, or this is essential to making sure that this child is getting the appropriate services, and then that information can be shared. There is an exception there, though, for information made confidential by federal law and information concerning clients and records of certified domestic violence centers. So those two things are not part of the grant of access. The third piece, is that the Section 39202-2R is also amended and expanded to allow people who the department is going to be seeking to place the child or to whom placement has been granted to have access to children's records. I think some of you may remember there was a case several years ago when a family adopted some boys who were sexually abused and had some really big issues that had not been addressed. And the children were placed in the home and subsequently adopted, and the adoptive parents had no idea, and it really was a tragic situation. So that sort of spawned a discussion about the responsibility that the department had to provide people with information that would enable them to effectively care for the children that were being placed with them. The one thing I would point out to people is when you read that language, persons with whom the department is seeking to place the child. When this language was developed, we had extensive discussions with the department to try our best to accomplish the goal of making sure people are adequately prepared to care for the children that are being placed with them with the child's concern for privacy. You know, the department looks at, investigates all kinds of people to place children with, and in some circumstances is doing a home study or looking at them as a potential placement just in order to rule them out. So when we were working with the department on this, we said, you know, it's not really appropriate for everybody who kind of stands up and says, the child can come with me, to get a 4.5-inch file of dependency information. So when we did to work it out to the best of our ability was say that the department has to be seeking to place the child with the people. So if they don't have an approved home study on someone, they can't really be trying to put the child there. So if you think that people are getting access to information that they shouldn't have, if you think that you know, they're doing ICPC on 26 people, just to give a ludicrous example. This is somewhere where I think we may have to get in court and start looking for a fairly narrow interpretation of this. If it's in the child's best interest to not have someone get access to their file, then I would suggest, unless the person has been, somehow determined to be qualified to take care of the child, and that the department really does want the child to be there, and it's not just the fact that the department is looking around and kind of getting a check of the landscape to see who might or might not be qualified, then I would suggest that you could argue that this requires actual intent on the department to put a child in a particular placement. And I think that that is bolstered by the fact that the second half of it says people with whom placement is granted. There are also some examples in the new 39202, and I will just flip to them. They say, including foster parents for whom an approved home study has been conducted, the designee of a licensed residential group home, an approved relative or non-relative with whom a child is placed pursuant to 39402, pre-adoptive parents for whom a favorable preliminary adoptive home study has been conducted, adoptive parents, or an adoption entity acting on behalf of a pre-adoptive or adoptive parent. So that list really does indicate that there's some kind of decision that the people are qualified and, you know, have demonstrated their ability to care for the child. It would seem to me that that would rule out, for example, the parents of a prospective father who's not had a DNA test yet. Things like that. If you think it's appropriate to narrow the scope of who the information is being used to, I would suggest that you had some space to litigate that under this new section. The last section that I wanted to mention in Senate Bill 126 is that 39202 is also amended to require that DCF keep its records and reports of the cases until the children in the case are 30. So that's good news that they're not going to be kind of, you know, putting everything through the shredder the minute the kid finishes, you know, the IL program. They are also required within 90 days of the child's release from custody or supervision to give the child or the child's, to give the child's caregiver or to give the young adult formerly in DCF custody notice on how to get the records. So not only are they keeping the records, the statute requires them to maintain them in an accurate manner, but now also you've got the trigger of how is anybody going to know that this happens? The department is going to tell them. 90 days after the child's release from the custody or supervision of the department, they're going to get notice on how they can get their records. So that's Senate Bill 126. I'm going to stop for a few seconds and see if anyone has any questions.
I have a question. If I came late into the conference, do I need to let anyone know?
Nope, I think you're good.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. It's kind of an anonymous conference. the third topic that we're getting, number three of four, is House Bill 381, and that was by Representative Nick Thompson and Senator Rhonda Storms. It is called the Zahid Jones Jr. Give Grandparents and Other Relatives a Voice Act, and it was named after a child who was tragically killed in the 20th Circuit a number of years ago, and the grandmother had sort of been crying out for help and had never sort of gotten any traction with her concerns. And so Representative Thompson has been on a mission since then, really, to make sure that when relatives are involved and in the child's life and have good information, that those people understand how they can get access to the judge and be informed of when the dependency proceedings are taking place. And then on the flip side of that, that the stakeholders are paying attention and being certain that they are asking the right questions of the right people, namely relatives. So the legislative intent, as it is articulated in the statute, is to ensure that relatives get notice of all proceedings and hearings. And then they go through the statute, and the big place where it happens is in 39502. There's a brand new subsection 19, which requires that the attorney for the department notify orally or in writing a relative who requests notification of the date, time, and location of the hearing that he or she has the right to attend all hearings, to submit reports to the court, or to speak with the court. So it's going to be the responsibility of the department's attorney to kind of put everybody on notice. Then throughout Chapter 39, for example, Section 39.6011 is amended so that the case plan has to include a description of the case manager's duty to forward any request of a relative to the DCF attorney. So if the caseworker gets it, then that person has an obligation to forward that on to the attorney. The 39.301.15 talks about how relatives can submit their request in writing. Let me restate that. So we have these provisions that kind of say, how do you do it? When does it happen? Whose job is it? But then there are a little protections that say, for example, the court can release the attorney from the department from their responsibility of continuing to notify the relative if the relative's involvement starts impeding the process or is detrimental to the child's well-being. It's clear that the failure in Section 39301, the failure of the department to actually notify the relative is not going to result in any kind of part of the proceeding being nullified. So there's now, you know, we have these protections. We're involving these people, making sure that they're going to be heard, but also being certain that the proceeding continues to move on. The other thing I wanted to mention was also in 39301 with regard to the protective investigations, there is now a new requirement on the caseworker to contact relatives if the parents are refusing voluntary services and those relatives can be found. So all in all, just kind of pulling them into the system. Section 39.5085 is amended to allow DCF to establish protocols to kind of manage the relationships between the department, the grandparents, the relatives, and they also may be developing liaisons to ensure placement stability in extended family settings. Moving on, in House Bill 381, there is a new provision that I'll just mention to you. I don't think it will affect your practice necessarily. 39301, when an investigation is begun, if the report was received from someone I know we say mandatory reporters, but that's always inaccurate because mandatory reporter is everyone. If a report's received from one of the reporters who has to leave their name with the hotline, then the protective investigator has to give that person his or her contact information, and the reporter must be advised that he or she can provide a written summary of their report to the Central Abuse Hotline to the investigator, and then that has to be kept with the file. So I suppose it's possible that you may run into these situations where you have multiple abuse reports and someone who's saying to you, well, I called it into the hotline and no one ever addressed XYZ. At a minimum, for individuals identified in 39201 as being required to leave their name, they are now going to get the information that they can write something up and that can then be put in the file. So I guess the other way that might come to you is if you actually see something like that in the file, but that's a new provision in 39301. This bill also amends Section 39202. We talked about how there was an amendment in Senate Bill 126 for individuals with whom the department was seeking to place children. We have another expansion of the confidentiality, 39202.2, to enable physicians and mental health care professionals treating children to have access to confidential information. If you look at House Bill 381, you may notice that all of the provisions of Senate Bill 126 are in it. Sometimes when people's legislators are concerned that their bill may not get on the calendar, they may amend the substance of their bill into something that is certain to move and be passed. So that's what happened with Senate Bill 126. It passed on its own, and it passed when it was also the entire contents of that bill are contained in Senate Bill 126. So if you end up looking at the bills, you will notice that. So that is the presentation on House Bill 381. Anyone have any questions on House Bill 381? Okay. The next bill that we're going to talk about is Senate Bill 1128, which was by Senator Rich, and it's House Bill 783 by Representative Kirk Kelly, and it is on educational surrogates. The bill starts out by defining educational surrogate, which is a concept from the IDEA, and outlines the circumstances and the procedure for appointment of surrogate parents. The definition is, what they did was they put these provisions in existing 390016, which deals with education, and they put the definition of surrogate parent and define it as an individual appointed to act in the place of a parent in making educational decisions and safeguarding the child's rights under the IDEA. Section 3 of the bill, there's a lot of legislative intent language, and then Section 3 of the bill begins to talk about appointment. What they do is for children in Chapter 39, they assign the responsibility for appointing surrogate parents to both the dependency court and the district school board superintendent. So it's not anybody's exclusive province to handle this. The two, entities are supposed to kind of work together to do this. Surrogate parents are appointed for children known to DCF who have or are suspected of having a disability. Those are the first two qualifiers. They're known to DCF, they have a disability or are suspected of having a disability. And either no parent can be located, or a court has determined that no person has the authority, willingness, or ability to serve the child's educational decision maker. So again, when you see this, it's not going to be all the kids that are in dependency court. It'll be those that either have or are suspected of having a disability, and then who either don't have parents or whose parents are not going to be able or who are not willing to work on their school issues, their educational issues. The statute lists qualifications, again, in subsection 3, and there's a requirement that people complete training using materials approved by the Department of Education. The next section is on appointment, and this is the part I think that most of you are probably aware of, is that there are limits on who can be appointed, but the law specifies that a guardian ad litem may be appointed. And what the IDEA does is they attempt to sort of take out of the pool of people available to serve as surrogate parents anyone who may have a conflicting interest. So if you are licensed by DCF, I think more effective to do would be to give you the list of the people who are not approved to do it, instead of trying to paraphrase or make examples. They talk about the guardian ad litem can serve, but neither the district school superintendent nor the court can appoint an employee of DOE, an employee of the local school district, a community-based care provider, anyone who works for DCF, or any other public or private agency involved in the education or care of the child. So there's a desire to get someone who's sort of independent, is the point that I just wanted to make to you. So when you are looking for individuals to do this, just be aware that there is sort of a neutrality requirement that's described in the statute. One interesting point in terms of the use of the guardian ad litem as the surrogate parent is this: the statute says that when it's necessary to appoint a surrogate parent, if a guardian ad litem is on the case, the guardian ad litem must be considered first when the school district is making the appointment. And I don't know if this was an oversight or some sort of error, but that language is only in the provision about the appointment by the school district superintendent. So the same sort of give guardians ad litem the priority is not present when the court is making the appointment. So I don't really know how that's going to play out for people. I know that with our new focus on education and making certain that educational advocacy is being conducted for children, it may be that we're just stepping up and taking the appointments anyway. But I did just want to make you aware of that, that first of all, when the district, if the district school board is making the appointment and you're the guardian on the case, you can go in and say under the new, under 390016, you know, I need to be considered first, and then if you are a person who's completed the training using DOE materials, then, you know, you could, then you are someone who could be appointed, and they'll have to recognize you as a surrogate parent. The court doesn't really have to do that, but given the fact that the court is so familiar with the guardian, and if the guardian has the training, then it may just happen as a matter of course. After the appointment is made, whoever makes the appointment, if the court makes the appointment, then the district school superintendent has to take it, and vice versa. Either one has to respect the appointment of the other. Additionally, the law says that if the child moves from school to school district to school district, then the appointment needs to be undisturbed, that you don't appoint a new surrogate parent if the child is moved. Now, another thing I just wanted to point out with regard to this language is the language in the statute says that the appointment has to be accepted by any subsequent school or school district, and then the words are, without regard to where the child is receiving residential care. My understanding is that the intent of this provision was to ensure stability in the appointment of the education of the surrogate parents. Unfortunately, as we all know, residential care is a term of art in dependency court. So there's been some discussion, particularly among the Juvenile Rules Committee, about how this is going to be interpreted. And because no one is aware of any intent to only afford stability for educational parents to people in, to children in residential care, that the intent was really to capture all the kids who had surrogate parents, we, at a minimum on the Juvenile Rules Committee, felt like we didn't want to do anything to restrict its interpretation. So you may just want to be aware of that. Should these appointments be, you know, controversial in any way, that you could get that objection. But for the most part, the intent of the law is to ensure the stability of the appointment, and hopefully it won't be an issue for people. I will tell you that the juvenile rule that has been drafted and submitted to the Florida Supreme Court is not going to restrict the interpretation. It's not going to use the words residential care just for this exclusive purpose. The trigger for appointment of the educational surrogate is as early as shelter. It's in 39-402-11D, and it says that the court can appoint a surrogate parent or refer the child to the district school superintendent as soon as the determination is made that the parent is unavailable pursuant to 39003B. So one thing I would say, again, as you are looking at these appointments and getting them, having a parent be unavailable under the traditional kind of discussion that you have when you're looking for parent is a little bit different than being unavailable as defined under 39003B. What that says is no parent can be located. I touched on it earlier. No parent can be located. The courts determine nobody has the authority under IDEA, or no person has the authority, willingness, etc. So the fact that somebody didn't show up, you know, may may be the beginning of a possible appointment, but then if that person does come into the proceeding and is effectively making decisions about the child's education, then that may not be a situation where you are appointing a surrogate parent. So just remember that that definition of unavailable is tied back to 00163B. The statute goes on to talk about the duties for the surrogate parent. They are to be acquainted with the child and become knowledgeable about his or her disability and the child's educational needs. They are to represent the child in all matters relating to the identification, evaluation, and educational placement and the provision of a free and appropriate education to the child. They are to represent the interests and safeguard the rights of the child in educational decisions that will affect the child. So that's basically the appointment process. The next place that we see reference to the surrogate parent is not until 39701, and that section is amended to require that the court determine who holds the right to make educational decisions of the child. A surrogate parent can be appointed at any time, but the two triggers that you have are in 39402, subsection 11, and then again in 39701. But that doesn't mean that if you are, you know, at an arraignment and you've discovered that the child needs a surrogate parent, that it's that you, you know, shouldn't go ahead and make the request. There are some rules and some forms that the Juvenile Rules Committee did to facilitate this. So I don't know when those will be released by the court. I think they just went up in the last couple of weeks, if they're even up there already, but there will be a form for appointment of a surrogate, an educational surrogate, and there will be a rule clarifying that at any time it can happen. So just be aware that you're not limited to the shelter hearing and the JR to make sure that the child's educational needs are being properly addressed. Another thing, so that's educational surrogacy, and then there are a couple other issues, changes that Senate Bill 1128 made on this topic that are separate from the surrogate parent issue. They amended Section 39402 to put a new requirement on the court to ask the parents to consent to provide access to the child's educational records. And to give that information to the court, the DCF, CBC's guardian ad litem, and the attorney for the child. So this is another effort, of course, to make certain that we know what's happening with the child's education and that there's appropriate advocacy for it. You can get it right at the shelter hearing. If the parent's unavailable or doesn't consent, the court can make a determination that access to the information is necessary and then issue an order granting access. So that's educational records. They put the same language, almost verbatim, about the medical records. So now at shelter, you're getting educational records and medical records, which hopefully will really help the children and make sure that we know what's going on with them right out of the gate. Again, there's going to be a rule on this coming out. One interesting thing that happened in development of the rule was there was a discussion about the fact that even though this requirement is attached to the shelter hearing and therefore potentially the shelter order, if you include these findings in the shelter order and then people are using the shelter order to go out and demonstrate their right to access the records, you're creating a situation where children's private information and families' private information is being, you know, potentially shared with individuals who may have no other involvement in the proceedings but that they're the custodian of records. And so it was actually a good suggestion by Deborah Stroth with DCF, who said, you know, that's not really fair to kids and families. Wouldn't it be better if we had a separate order that simply says, you know, either these parents have consented to give access to these records, or these people are unavailable and the records are necessary, or these people have refused to give consent and these records are necessary, and this person is entitled to access, and just have them take that order around, that would be a better approach, and everyone agreed. So that, when that comes out, that is something that will be in the juvenile rules, assuming that it's approved by the court. So that's the change in 39402. There was also some changes in the actual chapters governing education, which are in the 1000s. There's a revision to section 1003.21, which deals with how the schools enroll homeless children. Or, you know, given the fact that they probably don't have records, you know, what do you do if they can't prove that they've had their immunization, this kind of thing. The legislature added children known to the department to the definition of homeless children. And this change will allow the children to have a temporary exemption to be admitted to school without the evidence of their age or their certification of the health examination, the immunization. So instead of waiting to get all that paperwork, the children can be enrolled immediately, and then within 30 days, the information has to be provided. But now at least these children can get into school and, you know, don't have to wait if their placement is changed or if they come into care and the information is not available. So that's really it for legislation this year. It was a crazy session with lots of leadership changes, and the budget sort of just sucked the life out of everyone. There were not a ton of bills passed, but these bills that we've just gone over, I think, will change the way that you guys are conducting yourselves in the dependency court. Let me just stop and ask if there are any questions about Senate Bill 1128 on the education of foster children. Okay. Does anyone have any questions of me generally about the legislative session?
I have a quick question. Going back real quick, I was thinking about the grandparents and the relatives, new legislation, if I may.
Yes, please.
Currently, the statute kind of defines them as a participant, but this kind of gives them a little bit more, a little bit more rights than they've had before. Generally, I'm in the 13th Circuit. We would invite them always to any of the JRs that we were having, or, if they wanted to, they could come to some of the hearings. But the judges have oftentimes, based either on their behavior or, on what they've been saying, have excluded them from the hearings. Does this require that they be included at the hearings, or just that they are able to provide feedback to the judge?
I agree with everything you said as the predicate to your question. What the bill is attempting to do, I think, primarily, is create some mechanism for relatives to understand how to participate. I think that's the first thing that the bill is trying to do. So that's why they're requiring the court to notify them. That's why they're requiring the CPI to give them, contact information and tell them that they can submit something. I think you're right that the second piece of the bill that is requiring DCF to give them notification is sort of opening up and increasing their rights a little bit. But on the other hand, you still have that provision that says if they are becoming disruptive to the proceedings, the court can discontinue their involvement. So I have not sort of read it to think whether or not they could really push the issue if a court said no. And my initial thought on that is that if the court has determined that the participation of the relative is unproductive, that that's going to be the end of the question. But until that happens, they are being told that they have a right to attend the hearings and that kind of thing. And let me just confirm that language, because I need to be sure that there's not a distinction between relatives and individuals who are providing out-of-home care. And that, now that you and I are talking about this, the requirement in the shelter provision about the court notifying people that they have a right to attend all subsequent hearings, etc., is for people that are providing out-of-home care for the child. So I'm not entirely sure that that's a change in the law. If you are the person who is provide, you know, who has, you know, who's has the child in their house, to be coming to the hearings and providing information to the court. Some of the other provisions that we've talked about talk generally about relatives, but the provisions in the shelter piece and the piece about the having the right to attend the hearings are for relatives who are providing out-of-home care. So I think that distinction may not make this as big of an expansion as it would be if you simply gave a right to all relatives. Does that help at all?
Yeah, that does. And it'll be interesting to see. I just know that we get a lot of relatives coming in. It'll be interesting to see how our judges start to apply this.
Yes.
Thank you.
Absolutely. What other questions do people have? Just generally about the session, any questions? Isn't someone going to ask me, where's Chapter 39? Chapter 39, we hope, is imminent. Kelly Rosano in our office did a fantastic job helping me put together the Chapter 39, and we sent that off to the department for printing on the 15th of June. And we are waiting for our copies. And the Office of the State Courts Administrator helps produce that too. So we're hoping that just any day we'll have boxes and boxes of Chapter 39 coming in, and we ordered hundreds. So we'll be getting those out to the circuits just as soon as humanly possible, and I apologize for any kind of apologize for the delay. What else do people want to ask?
Senate Bill 1128, the educational surrogate?
Yes.
Earlier you said something that the surrogate parent will remain appointed with the child for changes between districts.
Yes.
For example, we're in the 15th Circuit. If a parent is unable to care for the child, then there's a relative in Tallahassee. Should whoever was appointed as the educational surrogate here remain?
Well, that's a good question. When I was talking about that, the point I was trying to make was that in a situation like you had, if the child was moved to Broward and you as the guardian wanted to remain on as the educational surrogate, then that person should remain on. But there are sort of more technical provisions in subsection 3B6 that say the surrogate parent shall continue in the appointed role until one of the following occurs, and it goes A through F, and it talks about if a child moves to a geographic location that's not reasonably accessible to the surrogate parent, then the parent does not have to continue. The provisions that I was just sort of pointing out allow you to continue, and I wanted you to have that information in case a district school superintendent said, oh, no, no, in Broward, this is the way we do it, or in Dade, this is the way we do it, and this new person will be there. You would be able to say, no, I'm sorry, I am entitled to continue in this role regardless of the child's movement from school district to school district. But in terms of terminating or discharging the surrogate parent, there's a list of like six things that can happen, including if the child achieves permanency or if the surrogate parent just no longer wishes or is unable to represent the child. So that kind of technical discharge stuff is in there and does include the situation you described.
Okay, thank you.
What else do people have?
A question about the access to records of children in foster care.
Yes.
You have it titled Access to Records of Children in Foster Care, but is it really access to records of children in protective supervision? As I understood your summary, it sounds like records of any child that's a dependent child would be open to, for example, the guardian and the other parties, and the child themselves when they turn 18.
Yes, you are exactly
okay.
Right. That was
okay.
I'm not sure why we used that title. I'm just looking to see if it was in the in one of the drafts of the legislation, but your comments are more accurate, and the title of the actual statutory section is called Records Concerning Children, and in number one it talks about the case record of every child under the supervision of or in the custody of the department or the department's authorized agents, CBCs, etc. So thank you for correcting that, because that is more precise. Thank you. What else do people have? If you don't have any more questions for the phone, that is fine. I hope this has been helpful to people. Anyone who needs anything, has a question, starts seeing these provisions applied in a way that doesn't seem like it makes sense to you, is always welcome to call me or send me an email. So please don't hesitate to do that. And Mary Kay, unless you have anything else, that is all I have.